Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to another newly recorded episode of Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And I'm going to be speaking today with Jeremy Rifkin, author of 20 books about the impact of scientific and technological changes on the economy, the workforce, society, and the environment. And you can learn more at F as in Frank, FOET.org. Stands for Foundation on Economic Trends, but FOET.org. After a three-year hiatus, since Trump's Electoral College victory, I've been doing a new interview every other week. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on her book No Is Not Enough, Arlie Hochschild on her book Strangers in Their Own Land and the Stories That Divide Us, Robert Wright on why he's a Buddhist. This show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. And podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Podomatic, Google Play, SoundCloud, everywhere you can find podcasts, basically. And as I do every week, I want to plug participation. And here's some organizations and websites you want to be in touch with. One is indivisible.us. Indivisible was started by some former congressional staffers. It's got at least 5,000 local branches. They will send you an email every week telling you how to take part and participate in resistance to the Trump administration and the work forward for the just and healthy planet we all need. Indivisible.us. Two organizations that for a long time that are longtime organizations that have been primarily digital, but ever since that election, they're working more closely with the grassroots on a national basis. MoveOn.org, MoveOn1word.org, and in the state of California, Courage Campaign, one word, CourageCampaign.org. Two that are very specific, Five Calls. That's the number five in the word calls, fivecalls.org, which highlights calls that are relevant and timely to make to your representatives. And Town Hall Project, one word, townhallproject.com, which tells you when your representatives are going to be holding meetings in your district so you can go and meet them face to face. And finally, because climate change is so critical, look into 350.org, the number 350.org. They are the largest and I think the most active global organization working toward climate change. They were big organizers in the U.S. of the recent global climate strikes on the 20th and the 27th. I first met today's guest, Jeremy Rifkin, at a conference in 1989. We were just chatting for a moment. It's been 30 years. At the time, I was acting and screenwriting, and he was talking about climate change. And he was talking about climate change then. He's talking about climate change today. In fact, it was following one of his talks that year in Los Angeles that two Hollywood environmental organizations were born. Rifkin has been a guest on this show several times over the years. He's a big thinker, a trend observer, and a synthesizer. So when I learned he'd written a book on the Green New Deal, I reached out for this conversation. I looked to Jeremy to put the bold proposal in context, pulling together the scientific, the technological, the political, the economic strands of a critical conversation about our future. Jeremy Rifkin is an advisor to the European Union, the People's Republic of China, and heads of state around the world. He has taught at the Wharton School's Executive Education Program at the University of Pennsylvania since 1995 and is the president of the Foundation on Economic Trends in Washington, D.C. That's the website I suggested, FOET.org. His books include The Third Industrial Revolution, The Empathic Civilization, The European Dream, The Age of Access, The End of Work, and his latest, The Green New Deal, Why the Fossil Fuel Civilization Will Collapse by 2028, and The Bold Economic Plan to Save Life on Earth. Welcome again, Jeremy Rifkin, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
So nice to be with you again.
Yep. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Wednesday, October 2nd. So as you know, having done the show a few times, I like listeners to get a feel for the people, and not just the work and the ideas that we talk about. So can you tell us briefly a bit about your path to the work you're doing today? And I'm not just asking, you know, why you wrote this book. We'll get to that. But sort of more your personal path, so we get a sense of you, and feel free to go way back, mentors, moments of decision, turning points, that sort of thing.
I'm not sure where we began, but I will say this. I was a student back in the 1960s at the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania, and I ended up teaching there. Yeah. In the executive program many, many decades later. But during my undergraduate experience there, where I was immersed in economic theory and practice, I began to think that economics was too siloed as a discipline, and that economics is really about a broader understanding, an anthropological understanding of how people relate to each other in their economic lives. And so that sort of led me on both an intellectual journey and very quickly an activist journey as well. I think I was active in the civil rights movement and, of course, the Vietnam War, the anti-war movement. But my first engagement with the fossil fuel civilization was in 1973, and you might remember this. Back in 1973, OPEC imposed an oil embargo on U.S. on oil for the U.S. And within a matter of weeks, there was a shortage of gasoline, and people were lining up in their cars over streets for miles to try to get a few gallons of gas.
Mm-hmm.
And the prices were hiked way up because of the OPEC oil embargo. And this is the first time that people started to take a look at how oil companies dealt. And the fact is they thought the oil companies were taking advantage of the OPEC embargo by spiking prices and profiting from it. So there was a huge amount of anger across the country against the oil companies. And at that time, I had formed an organization called the People's Bicentennial Commission to present a counter celebration for America's 200th anniversary, which was to be in 1976. So when this oil embargo hit and the American public became outraged about the high price of gasoline, we realized this was just a weeks away from the 200th anniversary of the Boston Tea Party.
Right.
And, of course, it conjured up the picture of, the East India Company and the similarities between their rapacious behavior and the oil companies today. So we put out a call across Boston and New England to join us on the 200th anniversary to protest the oil companies. Well, we were surprised. That day came, and there was a replica of the T-ship in the harbor. The mayor was there. National officials were there. And we simply asked people to come and protest. On that morning, it was a snow blizzard.
Uh-huh.
And we thought no one would show up. 20,000 people showed up. Union people, students, families. And on a blizzard, we all walked down from Faneuil Hall, where the original Tea Party activists were, and we protested at the harbor. And then fishermen from Gloucester came up the harbor, and they jumped on the ship and walked up on the mast and threw empty oil barrels into
Boston
the sea.
Harbor, yeah.
And this was with protests saying, impeach Exxon, dirty oil, dirty planet. And the next day, the New York Times said this was the Boston Oil Party of 1973. That was my first introduction. And that was the first protest ever, as far as we know, against big oil. And then in 1980, I published the book Entropy. And this book came out just months after the National Academy of Science issued its first report on climate change. And this was the first book to address that issue in 1980. And in that book, we recommended that we make a transition from oil to solar and wind technologies and all of the various accompanying transitions we needed to make. So that's when this all got started.
That's a good place to take it from. And let me just mention a couple of things that came up for me as you were saying that. One is 1973, as far as I know, in addition to being, the inflation that basically drove Jimmy Carter from the White House, the inflation that arose because of OPEC, if I'm not mistaken, 73 was about the time that the U.S. fell for the first time from being the number one producer of fossil fuels.
Yeah.
And people might notice that 73 is also when the wages in America began to no longer track with the rest of the economy.
And that was the beginning, really, of of the politicization of the neoliberal agenda, the University of Chicago School.
Yeah, I mean,
that's when it started. It all started around the same time.
Yep. And then the other thing I was going to say is you were active in a bicentennial organization. I actually did a documentary with Robert Theobald, someone who you probably on the same idea, which was sort of a counter view of the bicentennial. So, okay, so this book, we've heard about the Green New Deal. Let me set up a little bit of context, by the way. Most people, I assume, have heard about the Green New Deal for the last year or so in the work of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the Sunrise Movement and so on. But as I assume you know, this notion of a wartime mobilization, I first spoke with Lester Brown when he was he had just left World Watch and was at the Earth Policy Institute in 2008. And he was making the point then that that it was going to take a mobilization similar to World War II. And that, I think, is one of the threads of the Green New Deal. And then I also spoke with Mark Hertzgard at The Nation. He had a cover story in The Nation back in 2009 calling for a global Green Deal. So let me throw it to you. What's your sense of the evolution of this notion?
Well, it started around 2009. Let me say that I had migrated to the EU around the late 1980s to work with the Green parties and work with EU heads of state on a shift into a zero-emission economy, because I thought that the EU was the idea factory, that things were moving here, and that we needed to move it across the pond. The EU was the other major superpower, and if we could start to make a shift to address global warming there, it would come back to the U.S. eventually. And so the Green New Deal term actually emerged around 2009. A lot of this history is in the book. The term emerged in Europe with the Green parties. I was there during this. And that term has continued to frame the story in Europe across the political spectrum. So today, 2019, the incoming president of the European Commission, which is, you know, equivalent to our president of the United States, Ursula von der Leyen, announced just recently that the Green New Deal would be the centerpiece of the EU plan for the next 5 years. And this time we're going to go all the way and completely move to a zero-emission economy. And then the Green New Deal term then kind of went over the Atlantic when the Green Party candidate, Jill Stein, used it. And then, of course, it went to Cortez and Sunrise, et cetera. So there's a long history of this, but I should say there's a different conception of the Green New Deal in Europe than in the United States, which we should get into a little bit later.
Yeah. And when you said that the incoming head of the EU says it'll be the kind of the foundation, do you mean the foundation of their environmental policy or the foundation of all policy?
All policy.
Very
across
good.
The economic waterfront. We see this as an infrastructure transition on the scale of the shift from the agricultural age to the first industrial revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to make sure it's done quick, that we can put this transition and infrastructure in place and be off a carbon-based civilization in less than 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we think we can do it.
So we got this back. So we got 10 years of history in the EU, 10 years kind of in the background it's been around. And then, as I mentioned, it sort of hit the headlines with the election of some progressive folks and the sit-in at Nancy Pelosi's office by Sunrise Movement, the submission by Senator Markey and Representative Ocasio-Cortez of a plan. And we could do two things right now. One is, can we outline the plan that they've proposed? Do you have that? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it started back in 2007, a little bit earlier, when Chancellor Merkel came into office. She asked me to come to Berlin in the first few weeks to help her address the question of how to grow the German economy on her watch. And the first thing I asked the Chancellor is, Madam Chancellor, how do you grow the German economy when your businesses are plugged into a 20th century second industrial revolution of centralized communication, fossil fuel and nuclear power, internal combustion vehicles for transport and mobility, and that infrastructure peaked in its efficiency more than 10 years earlier. And I said, so you can have market reform and labor reform and fiscal reform and stimulate a lot of Steve Jobs type of startups, but as long as they're plugged into that old infrastructure to manage power and move Germany, you're never going to move forward into the world we need to be in. And I said, now that's coupled with a bigger problem. The economic infrastructure of civilization is now dying based on fossil fuels. But at the same time, after two centuries of industrial activity based on fossil fuels, we're in real-time climate change. And at the time, we said, we have to move quickly. We are very, very late. So the combination of an old, dying Second Industrial Revolution infrastructure to manage power and move society and real-time climate change, which was now taking us to an extinction event, was the trigger that moved Germany forward and then Europe. Then in 2007, I worked with the European Parliament, and I drafted a resolution which became very important. It was called the 2020-20 Formula. The European Commission was drafting a similar resolution at the time, where we set targets that every nation state had to increase their aggregate efficiency by 20% by 2020, reduce their global warming emissions by 20% by 2020, and increase the renewable energy, solar and wind, by 20% by 2020. So I drafted that resolution for the Parliament. We got it passed. Then the European Commission simultaneously was working on it there, and that was the time that Germany was heading up the European Council. It was a perfect moment.
Yeah.
That's what set this whole thing in motion. So now, with the incoming president now, who is the former German defense minister, Ursula von der Leyen, we're now ready to move this transition. Now, there are some big differences, all right?
Yeah, let's talk about that. Yeah. The differences between
all,
the U.S. proposal and the EU proposal.
And that's one reason I wrote the book. I did this book in 6 months, and I had been working on another book, and my wife said, no. You've got to show the differences. When you take a look at the Green New Deal proposals coming out of the presidential candidates, and there's some really good ideas, but they are all very centralized and top-down, and very similar to what we did with the FDR New Deal in the 30s, mm-hmm. where the federal government orchestrated these plans, imposed them on society, and moved it forward. And there were some very good programs. The problem is that's not the way infrastructure paradigm shifts emerge. So if you look at all the presidential candidates, it's a laundry list of programs, but there's no narrative. And secondly, they're top-down for the federal government. Here's the rub. The states own 93% of the infrastructure and are responsible for 75% of all the improvements. We are a federal republic. And so anyone that thinks that the federal government's going to impose this and then deploy this like we did in the 1930s is up for a rude awakening. When the first meeting I had with Chancellor Merkel is very interesting. At the end of the day, we had a glass of wine. She said, Jeremy, I like this third industrial revolution, zero-emission society for Germany. And I said, why? She said, you have to understand Germany. We are a federal republic.
Mm.
The regions determine their destiny, and the national government is responsible for codes, regulations, standards, alignment, and the narrative and the enablements. She said, this may not fit one of our neighbors. I won't say what other country that was. But the irony is America is a federal republic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the regions, and it's the states and the counties and the cities that are responsible for infrastructure. But if you look at all of these plans coming out of Washington, they look like something out of 1932.
Mm.
But here's where it gets interesting. But there's some good ideas within them. So we have to step back for a moment and ask the question. I asked this at the beginning of the book. We need a new economic vision for the world. It's got to be compelling, and we need a game plan to deploy it quickly in the developing and industrial world. We've got to be off a fossil fuel civilization, not net off, and most of it within 10 years and all of it in less than 20. So the key is to step back and ask how the great economic paradigm shifts occur. Then we get the roadmap for what we can do in our communities across America, and this is what we've done in Europe. There have been at least seven major economic paradigm shifts in history. Anthropologically, they're interesting. They all share a single common denominator. That is, at a moment of time, across a civilization, three defining technologies emerge and converge to create an infrastructure that changes the way the society manages, powers, and moves its economic activity, social life, and governance. And here's what they are. Number one, new communication technology to more efficiently manage economic activity and social life and governance, which is obvious. Two, new sources of energy to more efficiently power economic activity, social life, and governance, obvious. Three, new modes of mobility and logistics to more efficiently move economic activity, social life, and governance. So when communication revolutions converge with new energy regimes, new modes of mobility and logistics, it changes our built environment, it changes our temporal spatial orientation, it changes our business models, it changes our governance, it changes our narrative. And I use two examples, which so it's not esoteric. Great Britain, first industrial revolution in the 19th century, they had a convergence of communication, energy, and mobility. The Brits invent steam power printing, no more manual print presses. So you could have very cheap production of print, very quick, for something new called public schools and textbooks and then newspapers and magazines and journals. Then the Brits laid out a telegraph system in the last part of the 19th century. Steam power printing for communication and the telegraph system converged in Britain with a new source of energy, coal, harvested by the same steam engine they used for the print revolution. Then they put the steam engine on rails for locomotives for mobility. So the U.S., we did the same thing in the 20th century with the second industrial revolution, communication, energy, mobility, infrastructure shift. The telephone, a huge deal. I know everyone thinks the Internet's a big deal, but try to imagine for the first time in our history on this planet, people talking into a little device and someone listening and responding 1,000 miles away at the speed of light. Later, radio and television. Those communication technologies in the 20th century in the U.S. converged with a new source of energy, Texas oil wells. The oil came in. Then Henry Ford put everyone in the Model T in 1908, powered by those, by that oil. And that second industrial revolution went, it took us from urban environments to suburban environments, shopping malls, travel and tourism. The whole world took that model. The problem with that model, as I said to the chancellor, is that second industrial revolution has peaked in its productivity, is declining. It's old. The energies are getting more expensive. The technology that we use for communication, energy, mobility, and our infrastructure is all dying. So that's where we were in 2008 when energy peaked at $147 a barrel and the whole economy shut down that summer. That was the earthquake. The subprime mortgage debacle collapse was the aftershock 2 months later. So what we've been doing since then is we've been building, and I've worked with the last three presidents of the European Commission, almost all of the heads of state, to develop a Green New Deal third industrial revolution transformation. And here's the new communication energy mobility mix,
right,
which no one talks about in these programs coming out of Washington. They just laundry list. So here it is. The third industrial revolution is digital. So we're 29 years into the World Wide Web. The communication revolution's here. Everyone's on the Internet. All right? Pretty soon the whole world, 4.5 billion people now on the Internet. Now that digitized communication Internet that all of us are using is converging with a digitized renewable energy Internet. Millions of people now in neighborhoods and cooperatives and small businesses and large companies, they are producing their own solar and wind energy, where they live and work, and what they're not using, they're sending back to an increasingly smart, digitized electric utility Internet, just like we share information, news, and knowledge on the communication Internet. Same data, same technology, all digital. Now those two Internets, the communication Internet and now the renewable energy Internet,
yep,
where we can share energy across continents, as well as news and knowledge, is now converging with the third Internet, a digitized mobility and logistics Internet made up of electric and fuel cell vehicles powered by solar and wind from the energy Internet, and those autonomous vehicles are managed by the data from the communication Internet. And those three Internets to manage, power, and move society are what we see as a third industrial revolution, a Green New Deal, and we've developed that for the EU, and in the last 7 years, I've worked with leadership in China, and they've made this the core of the current 13th five-year plan. So the Europe and China are moving ahead. In the U.S., with the intentions good, there's a lot of, you know, activism, but you can't just put out a laundry list of proposals from the federal government. You have to deploy it, and that deployment will go to the states and the localities. The federal government will provide the incentives, the codes, the regulations, the standards, the alignment, and probably the national power grid, like we did the interstate highway system, but the states have to do that. I don't see that in these proposals.
Now,
see a lot of good ideas.
Yeah. In other words, it seems to me in these proposals, we see that why I referred to it first, that World War II sense of mobilization, I think, is in some sense, it is a narrative. What you're saying is it's a partial narrative. If you don't also deal with what you're talking about in terms of these revolutions, but the narrative that it can be done, the narrative that it can be done quickly, the narrative that we've done it before successfully when faced with a crisis that we could all agree on, I think that's a solid part of it. Then, of course, the individual things of linking, of providing transition training and education so that people don't get left out. So it isn't just technology and it isn't just regulation. It also provides some transition to pick up the slack from the changes that are happening. I think those are very solid. But what you're saying is what it leaves out. And it seems to me you're saying two things. One is a sense of these three digital revolutions and
coming together
and how they come together to create an opportunity that makes the other things you want to accomplish actually more easy to visualize and deploy. And the second thing, that by their nature, they are decentralized, and that, of course, World War II was centralized. And so if you begin to work from that analogy or that metaphor, and you are in the federal government, as these folks are, or running for president of the federal government, as these folks are, you sort of say, well, we could do this. What you're saying is that the very nature of these digital revolutions provide the opportunity for decentralization, and that there's much to be gained from looking at it that way. I would say the second thing the thing that fits with that is that when the federal government as it exists right now is actually an obstacle to these things, though these people are saying it could be the engine of these things. Right now it's an obstacle. The activity is at the state, regional, and local level.
Well, I agree. Perfectly said, actually. Thanks. I think that's exactly where it is right now. What's missing is the narrative. We have a laundry list. Once we have the narrative and we understand, as you said, the nature of the narrative, we know how it's going to be deployed. When you look at these great infrastructure transitions in history, the engineering of these infrastructures can tell you a lot about how the power is distributed, both the economy, the society, and governance. And while they're not rigid, they give you the outline of what the opportunities and restraints are. So no one pays attention to that anthropologically through history. I think this is the first book, I've done it a few others, where we really deal with this. I'll give you an example. If you look at the first and second Industrial Revolution infrastructures, they were all based on fossil fuels. Because remember, it's not just for transport. This whole civilization has been based on digging up the burial grounds of a previous period of history and taking the dead remains, long buried, of plant and animal life in the form of oil, coal, and gas, and taking them up from that ground, that burial ground, and we made it into every single part of this civilization. That's the wealth we've lived off of. And now we have the CO2 from the burning of those fuels. So fertilizers, pesticides, construction materials, pharmaceutical products, preservatives and additives for food, synthetic fiber, packaging, power, heat, and lights, all made out of those burial grounds.
And of course, plastics, the new thing that everyone realizes is choking us. Go ahead.
So here's the thing. That first and second Industrial Revolution infrastructures were designed to be centralized, top-down, proprietary and intellectual property, and they had to vertically integrate to create economies of scale to return profits to their investors because fossil fuels and nuclear power are the most expensive energies to refine, extract, and get to the society. So all the other businesses that come out of that fossil fuel civilization based on fossil fuels had to follow that same infrastructure mandate of centralized, top-down, proprietary, and vertically integrated. So we ended up with 500 global companies, and many of them were trying to transition their plans, 500 companies, Fortune 500, they're responsible for one-third of the GDP in the world, and they only have about 65 million people out of a workforce of 3.5 billion, which tells you a lot about the maldistribution, the inequality, because the infrastructure created it and the businesses that then moved toward it. Now, as you said, the third industrial revolution infrastructure for a Green New Deal, it's digital. And every digital native under 40, millennial Gen Z, will get this. The infrastructure is designed, engineering-wise, to be distributed, not centralized. It works best if it's open and transparent and not enclosed because you want the network effect. The more in the network, the more everyone benefits. And it scales laterally and favors cooperatives rather than vertical integration. Now, you can try to monopolize it like the Internet companies are trying to do, telecom companies, but you lose the productivity. You lose the efficiencies. So at least in terms of the platform, what we are beginning to see in Europe is that this is leading us from globalization to glocalization.
Mm.
This is part of the narrative. With globalization, when you had these centralized infrastructures based on fossil fuels, it led to national markets, then global markets, and then top-down global corporations managing it because of the nature of the platforms. What's happened now, and we're seeing this in Europe in real time because I'm working with them on the deployment. So if you go to places like northern industrial France, the Rust Belt, we did the plan for that whole region of France and other regions. If you go to these regions, it's not just Catalonia or Quebec or Scotland. All over the world, communities are now beginning to deal with each other virtually and physically in a global infrastructure where the fixed and marginal costs are so cheap they can bypass nation states. They can bypass global corporations in many instances and begin to engage each other directly through SME, small and medium-sized enterprises, through cooperatives, all platforms. So we're beginning to see a shift from globalization to glocalization, where localities are beginning to work with each other all over the world. This is happening very quickly. So this is power to the people, literally and figuratively power to the people. Now, nation states won't disappear, but they're going to have to be mediated now because a new power source is coming in terms of political power in line with this new engineering platform and new business models at the local, county, regional, and state levels. And here's the proof in the pudding. In the United States right now, while everyone's talking about these federal Green New Deal programs and all the Democratic nominees, the fact is 29 of its states in the U.S. have renewable energy portfolios, and they're targeting and incentivizing renewables, and they're moving. And if you look at California, Los Angeles, the mayor there, if you look at the governor of California, look at what's happening in New York State, we did the plan for Texas. You know how they're all talking about windmills in Texas?
Yeah.
And it's a wind. Well, my global organization was asked to come in back in, I think it was 2009 or 10, by CPS, the electric utility, which is the largest in the country, seventh largest city in the country, too. And we got them, they were looking at nuclear power versus wind. And we said your nuclear could go cost overrun. They had two nuclear power plants under construction. And we said you should go with wind. And at that point, you may remember those nuclear power plants did go cost overrun, and they got out with a loss in San Antonio. We took them into wind, and now they're the number one wind producer in the United States, number five in the world. And now that wind power has moved all the way to the Midwest, to the Plain States. And so when everyone talks about the wind revolution in Texas, that was all done in 10 years. And so when President Trump says he doesn't like wind turbines, he better rethink this because farmers and ranchers all over America are staying on their farms and ranches because of the profit they're making on their wind turbines. So all of this is possible, but you have to you have to know the narrative, you have to understand the infrastructure transition, you have to see that the national government provides the codes, regulations, standards, the enablement, the incentives, But the states and localities are going to have to do a lot of the heavy lifting here, too.
Very good. Let me tell people, this is Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Jeremy Rifkin, author of 20 books about the impact of science, technological changes, the economy, the workforce, society, the environment. And you can learn more at F, as in Frank, FOET.org. And for this week's conversation and many others, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, you can go to terrencemcnally.net or a world that just might work.com. They're the same website, terrencemcnally.net or a world that just might work.com. And if you want to get my weekly email telling you who's going to be on what we're going to talk about, and usually 8 to 10 articles to flesh out the conversation, you can sign up at my site or you can email me at temcnally@mac.com. Now you've mentioned, as you talked, I went, whoa, you know, three or four questions popped up, but one of them, was this notion that the narrative, are you saying that the narrative, obviously there is utility to the narrative. Are you saying that the narrative helps you devise your strategy or,
yes,
or as well as communicate it?
Correct, and that's what we found in Europe. We spent years in Europe on laundry lists, you know, on projects. Just what's happening now in Washington, it didn't work. People did not understand the vision. I'll give you an example. Back in 1938 at the New York World's Fair, the biggest exhibit was the General Motors exhibit. You remember hearing about this? And that what happened is millions of people also went to this exhibit at the New York World's Fair in 1938. And the exhibit, they took people out around a ceiling where they were high up, elevated off the ground in little buckets, you know, like you would see at an amusement park. And then they would look down, and when they looked down, there was a model across the floor, and it showed interstate highways with no traffic lights, suburbs, shopping malls, all of the theme parks, all of that. They were wowed. No traffic lights, interstate highway, a mobility revolution. After the war, when the GIs came back and everyone settled with their families, that led to the suburbanization of America and the interstate highway system. So what there was a vision that people understood. This is the vision we now understand in Europe and the vision we set up for China. In Europe, we call it Smart Europe. In China, where I've worked with the leadership, we call it China Internet Plus. Now, there are issues here, too. We have to deal with the dark side, the dark net. While we're introducing a smart technologies to move all of this, we have to deal with the question of network neutrality. How do we make sure governments don't purloin this to intervene in other governments' political process already happening? How do we make sure internet companies don't use our data and commodify it for third-party use, and then they take over our personal agency? Already happening. How do we prevent cyber terrorism and cyber crime? Already happening. So in Europe, we are really on this at the EU level, moving to make sure with antitrust, with regulations, that we make sure that this technology works on behalf of communities. It is not the purview of global corporations setting up surveillance for their own commercial property.
Now, by the way, let me cut in for a second, Jeremy. Obviously, you've touched on something that was cooking in the back of my mind anyway, which is that as we lay out the positive, as you say, that of the digital revolutions we are observing, we thought, I think, a lot of the people, at least at the founders of the internet and so on, saw that as a pathway to decentralization. And then we end up with these five giant corporations, which not only are the opposite of decentralization, but dominate us at the level, I think, of neurotransmitters. Do you know what I mean? It's like...
Yes, I understand what you're saying.
You understand what I'm saying. They not only control things, but they're tapping into your dopamine cycles and so on. This is scary stuff. I noticed that Europe has been much more aggressive. Do you see a pathway to successfully shifting this back to where it's meant to be?
Yeah, and I spent a lot of time in the Green New Deal, in the book on this. Every chapter we deal with this. What we're going to see is that the first round of this third industrial revolution smart infrastructure was captured by vertically integrated companies who took advantage of the cheap fixed and marginal costs. That's now changing. There's a younger generation. That was the Silicon Valley generation. There's a younger generation out of Greenport in Brooklyn, Berlin, Seoul, Korea. They are more socially conscious. And what we're saying is we want to use this technology, but in a much better way. For example, these big, huge centralized data centers you see, you know, in the ICT and Internet, they're going to be looked at as dinosaurs in a few years from now, because as we move to the smart infrastructure, edge data centers are coming in. And that means that all of our homes, our offices, our factories, where we work, where we live, are going to be retrofitted to make them resilient to climate change. They're going to become nodes. And every building will be a edge data center where you can blockchain your own data and work laterally rather than rely vertically on giant data centers for your social and economic life. Every building as a node becomes a micro power generation site for your energy and electricity, solar, wind, geothermal. Every building becomes a charging station for your electric vehicle powered by solar and wind, and becomes a storage unit in case you need energy or want to send it back to the grid. And we begin to see a more lateral movement where cooperatives, high-tech cooperatives, are going to become more the norm. Why? They're more agile than giant vertical integrated organizations. From a business point of view, and this is where we work, they're going to be more agile, they're going to be more high-performing, they're going to allow us to blockchain cooperative operations virtually and physically. This is actually starting to emerge in Europe right now, and it's just beginning in the United States. And so I think that the days are numbered for the big data centers and ICT. But let me say why I think that this is an important moment, and I want all your listeners to hear this. The marketplace is speaking. I know that on the liberal left, and you know I come out of the left, we don't want to, you know, the marketplace is always, you know, everybody's always got a problem with the marketplace, and certainly, you know, I've had my issues over 34 years.
Sure.
But what's happened here is very interesting, and I want to really focus on this for a few minutes.
Okay.
When we got that 2020-20 formula into law in Europe, the most important part was the renewable energies, where we said we need 20% renewable energies in every community in every state by 2020. We made the target. What happened is this, we then put in some feed-in tariffs so people could get a little premium for if they wanted to put solar or wind where they live or work and send it back. This allowed us to reduce the price because all of this entrepreneurial spirit emerged across Europe and people found cheaper and cheaper ways to introduce the solar and wind technology, all right? And so now we don't even need the premiums. Now, here's what I want your listeners to hear. As of this year, and all these stats are in the book, the levelized cost of utility-scale solar and wind are now way below the cost of nuclear, way below the cost in the market of oil, way below the cost of coal. And I want everyone to hear this. They have now the solar and wind cost for generating solar and wind are now just moved below the cost of gas. So what is happening here is a few years ago, Citigroup, the bank, said, oh, my God, they put out a report saying there could be $100 trillion in stranded assets in the fossil fuel industry. The economic unit of The Economist says at least $40 trillion. This is the biggest bubble in history. And all the studies we have in the book are in the last 12 months from the insurance industry, the banking industries, the energy companies, the transport. And what it shows is this, because this is on our experience in Europe. When solar and wind reached 14% of the electricity on the German grid, that was it. That was the collapse of fossil fuel and nuclear power. Why? There's a rule of thumb in what we call creative disruption. It's not so important how big the incumbent is in an infrastructure, but how fast the little challenger is growing. In other words, for example, in Germany, our fossil fuel nuclear electricity was 95-97%. But what was happening was solar and wind were moving quicker because the price was getting cheaper. So when solar and wind got to 14% of the electricity because the price was plummeting, that did it. And that collapsed fossil fuel and nuclear, and they lost hundreds of billions of dollars. So what we've seen in the book, we have studies now the United States will hit 14% of solar and wind around 2022 or 3. The globally, it'll be around 2026. So we're beginning to see this. The ICT, telecom, internet sector is already decoupling from fossil fuels. They're all going off-grid. Solar and wind's cheaper to protect their centers. Now the electric utilities are moving off of nuclear and fossil fuel because now solar and wind is cheaper. And here's the big one, transport. So right now, EVs are only 2% globally,
right?
Okay? They are growing exponentially. So the studies we have in the book from the auto industry, and we work with a lot of these industries. We work with the auto industries. I was just with all the auto industries in Chicago 2 weeks ago laying this out. And what's happened is in the transport industry, the EVs are getting so cheap that the unsubsidized cost of an EV, electric vehicle, will be competitive with internal combustions by 23 and cheaper by 25.
And when you say that, just so I can clarify, and I don't want to, you mean the cost of purchase or the cost of lifetime?
Purchase.
Okay.
Purchase. So by 2028, there are studies in the book. These are from the top consulting organizations in the industry. By 2028, about 20% of all the vehicles purchased each year will be EVs. That's the inflection point and the collapse of the fossil fuel civilization. And the reason is, and let me give you this, to show you how real this is, Volkswagen just announced 80 billion euros to completely transform the largest auto company by 2026, all out of internal combustion, and they're putting out the last internal combustion engine platform ever in 2026 or 7. Daimler's doing it. They're all doing it now. BMW. And by 2028, Volkswagen says they'll have 22 million EVs on the road, one quarter of the global production. They're all doing this. Now, what does this mean? I want everyone to hear this. We consume 90 million barrels of oil in the world each day. 60 million barrels go to transport, two-thirds. This is the collapse of the fossil fuel civilization. So the market is speaking, and no matter what kind of lobbying interest the fossil fuel industry does,
yeah,
it's going to be very, very, they can't keep up with the market. Now, the market, the invisible hand, can't do it alone. So in the Green New Deal, in the book, we say, the market is showing, and this is collapsing, but it's going to be up to local governments, states, it's going to be up to communities to now build out this new third industrial revolution, Green New Deal infrastructure quickly to fill that vacuum because of the collapse of the fossil fuel civilization. So if businesses don't create infrastructure, government does at the local, state, and level, and the national level. So the big mission here is to move with the states, move with the localities, have the federal government put in the codes, regulations, standards, incentives, and targets. But we've got to do that quick because right now, this is a great moment. The market is collapsing the fossil fuel civilization, and our studies show it will collapse with the biggest bubble in history by 2028. And those are the studies in the book from all the leading banks, financial institutions in the last 12 months. Our mission now is we better get organized in each community with community involvement as if we were in a disaster relief moment. And build out this new infrastructure that requires social capital, civil society engagement, local and state government engagement all over the United States right now. The moment's here and the opportunity is here.
Couple of questions. And you can answer this one pretty quickly, but a lot of people that I read and that I talk to say to do it as quickly as we're talking, to do the transition that's going to be necessary confront climate change, we're going to need nuclear in the transition. You don't think so?
Absolutely not. Don't need it. Now, we have nuclear power plants still online. I'm all right if they live out their normal life expectancy, not beyond.
Okay.
Not beyond. All
okay.
Right? We don't need them. They're too expensive.
Okay.
And certainly no new nuclear power plants need to be built. It's ridiculous.
Okay.
But that's also true with natural gas, coal,
right,
and oil.
Right.
What's happening is, this is so sad, we have banks financing natural gas power plants because they say, oh, well, they're not
transition.
As dirty, and they're a transition. That was true 10 years ago,
right,
not now.
Right.
Now what's happened is the reason they're collapsing in Europe is solar and wind is not only cheaper, but we do not need gas-fired power plants to back up intermittent energies. There's so much solar and wind coming in, we don't need them. And we don't need natural gas power plants to back up intermittent energies because as we digitize this electric utility internet, the actual data that we're using helps us aggregate when certain energy should be used or not, how to turn your utilities up or down in your homes and businesses so you can make money and not spend as much. So in other words, the actual analytics and data allow us to manage the generation of solar and wind from millions of players so that we can know when we need for peak moments, when we don't need it for peak moments. We simply don't need natural gas power plants in any way. So they're being stranded because they'll never be used.
So
they're putting in all these pipelines and all these plants. They're never going to use them.
So two things about this bubble, right? First, I want to make sure people understand what you're saying, is that much of the investment in the world, whether it's banks, pension plans, universities, and so on, when we talk about divest from fossil fuels, what we're actually saying is you own stock in companies that whose value is based to a great extent not on what they're selling today only, but on what they own in the ground or in the ocean. And when the tide turns, no pun intended, and that there's no longer economic value in pulling that out of the ocean or out of the ground, those are going to be $1 billion of stranded assets, and that's a crash like we haven't thought of before.
It's the greatest crash in history. It's the greatest disruptive moment, and it's the greatest opportunity. And that's why in the back cover of the book we've got Sir Richard Branson saying this is the moment. We got Sharon Burrows, the head of the International Trade Union Federation, saying let's move. We've got folks saying this, but let me be very, very clear. We're talking about trillions, not billions, number one, all right? And secondly, I think that we have to understand that that this moment has to move quick. People say to me, can we do this in the time frame we have? So in the book, and we work with the largest electric utilities and transport companies in the world, et cetera, here's what we think can happen. The first industrial revolution, the juvenile infrastructure, was laid out between 1860 and 1890, the railroads, the Homesteading Act, putting in the universities and land-grant colleges to train everyone, putting in the telegraph systems. It took 30 years. The second industrial revolution infrastructure was put in between 1908 when the Model T came out, mm-hmm. electrification, the telephone. And we got a juvenile infrastructure in 25 years by 1933 because the second industrial revolution could build off the infrastructure still there from the first.
Right.
The third industrial revolution will take less than 20 years. We can put a juvenile infrastructure in place. This we know in Europe and China we're doing it. And now in America, I want everyone to hear this. We can put a juvenile national power grid that can manage solar and wind energies from millions of players. We can put the juvenile infrastructure in across the country in less than 10 years, and the mature infrastructure to coordinate energy like we coordinated mobility on the interstate highway system in another 10. So we can also get to 50% solar and wind by 2030 and 100% by before 2040. And I don't mean net zero,
mm-hmm.
where you still have other forms. I believe we can do that. It'll be 10 years for a juvenile transformation, and within less than another 10 years, the late 30s, to a complete transformation of society.
Now,
will it get us there in time to stay under 1.5? I don't know, but this scenario is the only narrative I know, and when I meet with heads of state, I say to them, do you have another idea? Tell me what it is.
Yeah,
it's funny. This, and I wait for a minute.
Yeah, sure.
Silence. There is no other idea.
One other thing that haunts me, which is that we know crisis and opportunity, often two sides of the same coin. If we're talking about a multi-trillion dollar crash, does that end up taking down the economies of the world at the same time? In other words, the good news is, wow, it's the end of fossil fuels. But there's so much so much power and money tied up in it. Can we deal with that?
That's where the funds come in to finance this. So in the book, we spend a lot of time on how this is going to be financed. Now, I have no problem, and I favor more taxation of the super rich and changing our military budget priorities and all of those things, knocking out fossil fuel subsidies. But a lot of the financing is also going to come from institutional funds and pension funds. I wrote a book in 1978 called The North Will Rise Again, Pensions, Politics, and Power, on pension funds with a guy named Randy Barber. And what we found then is that Karl Marx could not have envisioned this, but pension funds, that's the workers' deferred savings, today is now the largest pool of capital in the world Karl Marx would be flipping in his grave. The workers, their pension funds are worth $41 trillion. So what's happening is these pension funds, and we say this in the Green New Deal, in the book, they are fast divesting from fossil fuels really quickly, especially public pension funds like New York and Berlin and London. Why? Because they see the collapse is coming, and they don't want their workers, millions of them, to then lose their pension funds. That's what happened in the coal industry. Coal became uncompetitive, and therefore Peabody and these coal companies went bankrupt, no pension funds, workers stranded, and that's why we're stuck in coal country. So the big pension funds, especially the public funds, now the private funds, are divesting from there, and they want to move into the new energies, the new technologies, because this is where the market is moving. This is where the business opportunities are moving. This is where the millions of jobs will be produced. So the key here is you got to bring in the labor movement. You got to bring in the public and private pension funds, along with other types of enablement. It isn't just about taxing the rich, which I'm in favor of.
Right. No, so it sounds
just
like
about more government debt. The money's there.
We got to wrap it up. It sounds to me like what we need is we need to accelerate divestment so that the people who have the money in those assets, it doesn't become a global crash, and accelerate infrastructure so that we're able to cope with the shift as it happens.
And one final sentence on that.
Yep.
What that means, what's missing is scaled projects. In other words, the pension funds are saying, we're hungry, we want to scale whole cities. What's missing now, and this is where we have to move, the cities, the counties, the states have to create roadmaps like we've done in Europe for infrastructure transition, because the money is sitting there saying, please, we need large-scale transitions of these cities.
So they have something to shift that money into.
Correct. That's all we're seeing are little pilot projects.
Yeah.
So you go to a city anywhere in the world, and they got their little hydrogen bus, their lead building, their little bike path. The money is now there. It's getting out of fossil fuels. It's collapsing. They're desperate for cities to take the responsibility, and counties and states in the U.S. like we're doing in Europe, and they have to come up with programs to put this infrastructure in. This means the whole community has to be engaged.
The book is The Green New Deal, Why the Fossil Fuel Civilization Will Collapse by 2028. And you heard that. And then The Bold Economic Plan to Save Life on Earth. The website is FOET. That's F as in Frank. FOET.org. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to TerrenceMcNally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website, TerrenceMcNally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement of guests and issues, plus 8 to 10 articles fleshing out the context and the conversation, email me at TEMcNally@mac.com or sign up at my site. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, anywhere you can find it. And you will find years of podcasts there. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can also follow me on Twitter, at McNally Terrence. Thanks to G. Lee, Mark Maxwell, Teddy Andrews in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. Thank you, Jeremy Rifkin. Keep up the good work.
Thank you very much.